really.
Petitioner in the case of Heaton versus Fulton.
May it please the court.
Please the court, I'm Russell McMaines, the co-counsel along with Mr. Rabbit. With Petitioner Alfred L. Heaton in this case, which largely centers upon the question as to the liability of an insurer, to wit Lloyd's, for the acts of an insurance agency, which have been characterized as being a soliciting agent, with regards to the delivery of a policy of insurance that the jury found, and those findings really have not been challenged to any significant application. With regards to the fact that an exclusion in that policy was not attached, and that was the exclusion relied upon by the insurer ultimately after a loss occurred in refusing coverage. The absence of that exclusion was also established at trial as being also absent from the loss payees. This is a physical damage coverage with regards to the policy issued by the underwriters at Lloyd's, that it was also missing from the loss payees policy. So that, and there is a finding of the jury that was essentially ignored. It was actually held to be immaterial. Quite to the contrary, our position is that it is quite material, as well as supported by the evidence, of agency, both authority and apparent authority, in the trial court, that was relied upon in the entry of the trial court judgment for actual and treble damages, and was then reversed by the Court of Appeals and rendered on the theory that as a matter of law, the Dade Mazner Insurance Agency, which was the alleged soliciting agent that had attempted to procure this insurance on behalf of our client, Mr. Heaton, from the underwriters at Lloyd, on an American Underwriters application form that had been supplied him, which was then attached to the policy itself when it was ultimately issued. But what was missing at all times under the contentions of Mr. Heaton, and of which he was never told, was an underage exclusion, that is an exclusion of drivers under the age of 25, despite the fact that Mr. Heaton, as the record reflects, repeatedly had reported lists of drivers to the Dave Mazner Insurance Agency, and in fact Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 is a transmittal of the information as to the specific driver involved in this particular collision loss, in which his date of birth is also reported on it, as to the driver, and that's reported as to Mazner's Insurance Agency. All of those facts really are essentially undisputed. That's Plaintiff's Exhibit 6. The application form that was assisted in being filled out by Mr. Mazner, and or by Mr. Cox at the Mazner Insurance Agency, was one of the American Underwriters form, which is Lloyd's general American agent. But Lloyd's, of course, is a surplus lines carrier. They are not licensed to do business in this state. They transact business through soliciting agents. They are the ones who chose the avenue of communication of the policy, the delivery of the policy. There really is no dispute about that. That policy was delivered, supposedly, to the Dave Mazner Insurance Agency. The testimony is then disputed as to whether or not the exclusion was attached at that time. There is testimony that it was attached. The jury obviously didn't believe that because he also testified that he sent the policy that he received directly on to the plaintiff, Mr. Heaton, in the form that he had received it from underwriters at Lloyd, and actually had a procedure set up whereby they checked to make sure that the policy was as received and then sent it on, which is responsible for a bona fide error finding in part that the jury also made.
Counsel, is it your position that under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the distinction between soliciting and recording are irrelevant?
Your Honor, that's one of our positions. That is perhaps the most extreme of our positions. There are also findings of direct liability on the part of Lloyd's that we have also relied upon. We do believe that the distinction that is drawn between soliciting agents and local recording agents, when we are talking about the focus of conduct of the agent that is selected for that purpose by the carrier itself to transact business, To wit, there is no delivery of the policy directly to Mr. Houston, so that we don't have a situation where there is an application for insurance that is done by a soliciting agent, and then the policy is forwarded directly from the insurer to Mr. Heaton. If that were done and the exclusion omitted then, there's really no question about the liability of the insurer with regards to having effectively misrepresented the terms on which it issued the policy, because it had not attached and given him a copy of the exclusion upon which its denial of coverage was based. What we have here is an intermediary that was selected by the insurer. And actually, Article 2102 of the Insurance Code, in as it existed at the time, specifically provides that a soliciting agent, even, is a person who is an agent for the carrier for the acts for which the carrier selects him to do. And what they selected to do in this case was the delivery. So in truth and in fact, whether or not the exclusion was deleted by mistake by the carrier in transmitting it to Dave Mazder Insurance Agency, or whether it was omitted in the transmission by Dave Mazder Insurance Agency to Mr. Heaton, should be immaterial to the liability of the carrier, because they're the ones who chose that mechanism for the transmittal of the insurance policy terms. That's a misrepresentation of the terms. We have a policy that has been issued that doesn't have an exclusion that the insurer is relying upon. We basically, therefore, have the effect, based on the jury findings and the record in this case, of a secret exclusion in the insurance policy that is not communicated to the insured, and that's what we seek to hold the insurer responsible for. It doesn't matter why it occurred.
It's always going to be a jury issue. In other words, the next case, Lloyd's may be, the jury may find that the local agent is not an agent of Lloyd's, and Lloyd's won't be responsible for it. Is this just going to be fact-based in each case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is fact-based to the extent that the communications that are intentionally done by the insurer are communicated through the soliciting agent.
But, I mean, there was no jury finding that Lloyd failed to send this to the insurer or something. I mean, the jury did not fix responsibility in this chain, did it?
It wasn't asked to, Your Honor. That's correct. The jury did find liability on Lloyd's for failing to inform him of the exclusion. And they did find that directly. Now, there's nothing in that issue whereby you can determine whether that is necessarily a finding that it wasn't on the policy that went to Dave Mazder, though that is certainly an inference if you take the testimony.
Failing to inform him.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. There is no finding, none requested, as to whether or not they failed to inform Mazder. The testimony is, and we don't dispute this, that Mazner was aware that this was the policy of Lloyd's, that they did have this type of exclusion ordinarily. Now, there is also disputed testimony that it could be purchased around by the payment of an additional premium. And that is part of the basis for the independent liability with regards to the breach of the contracts to procure and the arguments to procure with regards to the Mazner Insurance Agency, because they obviously theoretically knew of the existence of this, knew it was supposed to be there, didn't communicate that to Heaton.
Is that disputed? Is it disputed whether Mazner and Heaton discussed the 25 age limit?
It is disputed, Your Honor.
But
there
Mazner
is,
says they did, and Heaton says they did.
Yes, Your Honor.
But there's a
not
jury
surprisingly.
Resolution. There's a jury resolution.
That's correct, Your Honor. The first issue, and then the other issues are basically that they failed to inform him and that was a producing cause. The first issue asked whether or not the exclusion was attached. And the jury found that it was not attached to the policy that Heaton had. And
what I'm trying to understand is this, are you giving us any legal principles for saying when there is no jury issue on what Lloyd did in relation to Mazner, is that going to be something, I mean, the jury is going to decide a general question of agency in each and every case. And the facts will support an answer either way? Is that the way we're going to resolve?
I think with regards to the issue of delivery of the policy, Your Honor.
I'm talking about Lloyd being responsible in respondeat superior, or principal agency, I suppose.
That's correct.
Lloyd being responsible as a principal for the act of its agent in this case.
I think that they are responsible by
hearing. Is that because of the finding of the failure to inform, or because of the finding of actual and apparent authority?
Well, I think both, Your Honor, because in truth and in fact, they are the ones who did determine to submit, this is the way they transacted business in this state, was indirectly through the soliciting agent relationship.
But that's because of a factual finding by the jury.
We do have that factual finding, that's correct. Now, we do have, of course, we have the additional things in here in terms of the apparent authority arguments with regards to the use of their form, the American Underwriters forms.
Okay, so
with regards to the application.
You don't have to have these jury findings on agency in order to secure a judgment against Lloyd's.
Well, I think when they dispute that they have an agency relationship, and of course the problem we have here is that we have the agent that is simply attempting to parrot the argument that Lloyd's is making. That is, I don't have the authority to change the terms of the policy because I'm a soliciting agent. And I don't have any authority to misrepresent the terms of the policy. But we're not really talking about representations as to the coverage insofar as the imputation of liability to Lloyd's. We are talking about the act of delivery of a true copy of the policy. Who makes that decision? Who chooses that means? We do have the finding of agency there. And of that, there really isn't any dispute in the testimony. When I say that we probably wouldn't need a jury finding, I don't think it's disputed that Lloyd's sends the policy to Masner. It's not disputed that Article 2102 of the insurance code makes collection of the premiums, transmittal of the premiums, delivery of the policy, those issues, the responsibility of the company upon, for whom he is acting at that time. There really isn't any different reason, and I guess this is what our argument is, there's not any real different reason to treat an insurance broker any different than a real estate broker, in that they are frequently a dual agent operating for seller and buyer. And they operate for buyer in regards to certain things, they operate for seller in regards to other things. And so they can breach those duties, and there can be vicarious liability imposed when they are dealing with a duty which has been delegated to them by the principal. That is the general concept of principal agency. We think even without 2102, we would be there, but I think that's all that 2102 recognizes, is that when you have chosen this mechanism for communication, when there is miscommunication, there is responsibility for that on the carrier. They are the ones who chose it. We are not, as I say, we do not have the situation where they attempted to make a declaration of the policy terms and the conditions of coverage directly to the insured in terms of transmitting it to the insured. We have one where they chose the route of going through the soliciting agent. And when they do that, that agent, for purposes of the delivery of that policy, and what that policy represents, is there is no exclusion that they are relying on. So this is, in essence, a representation through them. Now, whether or not that exclusion, as I indicated, and your Honor is correct, there is no finding that, and none requested, as to whether or not that exclusion was there at the time that Masner received it from them. But then the question still bears on whose agent is he for transmitting the policy from the insurer to the insured and communicating its terms.
The jury did find, though, that the policy did not cover people under age 25, did it not?
Well, effectively, that's really not disputed, Judge, that the policy that they intended to issue, that it was their policy to ordinarily cover it, and there's not really, there is a policy that was introduced into evidence by the other side, which has an unnumbered, it's the only one of the exclusions that don't have a form number at the top of it, but it has an unnumbered under 25 exclusion on it, which they purport to be a copy of the policy. And that Lloyd's has. On the other hand, it doesn't purport, there is a testimony that that's the original policy, it's just that's the policy they intended to issue. And obviously the argument here and the way that the case was tried, it was tried on a theory, okay, that's the contract of insurance that you intended to issue and did in fact agree to go on the risk on and charge the premium for, but you never communicated that exclusion to the insured, and you should be responsible for that. And for that failure to communicate. They're the ones that chose the mechanism for that communication. So that whether or not the fault lay with the Home Office of American Underwriters, which of course incidentally did not have anybody produce a trial. So I mean basically we're talking about a carrier here who refuses to transact business in Texas directly, who refuses to deal with any other type of entity other than purportedly through soliciting agents, and then wishes to immunize itself from any activities with regards to the transmittal of the true terms of the policy, by virtue of just standing back and say, that's not our fault, he's a soliciting agent, he can't do anything, the policy we have in the Home Office, if you want to see it, you come up there and see it. That's otherwise what the principle that would be communicated by an affirmance of the Court of Appeals opinion in this case.
Was there any testimony of why Lloyd sent the policy to Masner to be delivered to the insured rather than mailing it directly?
That basically is their practice, Your Honor. And that testimony, that is the way it is handled. He is, Masner Insurance Agency was a surplus lines agent, which means that he could apply for the policy directly from American Underwriters. And in fact, there is, of course, testimony on the apparent authority issue here, just from a standpoint of additional factual matters, because while there may not be much fact dispute as to what I contend to be the actual authority issues, the apparent authority issues are obviously in dispute. The American Underwriters application form, which was then incorporated into a part of the policy, which was signed by Dave Insurance Agency, and the binder that was also issued. A binder was also issued, which is also an exhibit in the record. That binder also bears the title of the insurance agency. So that there are other indicia that there is a relationship much broader than just pure broker anyway that would give rise to the claims that we have as to apparent authorities that would support that issue. The Court of Appeals didn't go through any of that analysis, just said he's soliciting agent as a matter of law, and that means as a matter of law there isn't any liability. That they can enforce this secret exclusion with impunity and not have to be worried about any liability for not communicating.
The, yes, right. The duty to deliver the policy to the insured accurately, what is the basis, alleged basis for that? There's a charge of negligence and a charge of violation of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. I take it you claim that an insurer has a duty at law to deliver a correct copy of the policy and failure to do so is negligence.
Yes, Your Honor, because I think that's one of the conditions with regards to the insurance agreement itself is that they know obviously the terms and conditions of the insurance contract and the risks that they are paying a premium for. Now, as indicated, the liability against David Masner on that is really not very much, it's the subject of fact disputes, but they've been resolved and are largely, I believe, invulnerable to attack on appeal in their fact findings, that essentially the Masner Insurance Agency said, we will place this coverage, this is on the same terms that we've gotten coverage before for you with other companies, and so that the insured has every reason to believe that there is no such exclusion in there. And the question you have is, isn't there an obligation with regards to attempting to make a contract for the insurer to say that we are going to take a particular risk and then not identify what risk it is to the insured? I believe that we have ordinary principles that would arise out of the existence of the contractual relationship and the assumption of that underwriting risk in this case that would give rise to those common law theories. But essentially, effectively delivering a copy of the policy or causing it to be delivered by a third person. Wouldn't matter if they went out and hired somebody or had somebody that was, in essence, a paperboy deliver it. And if he lost part of it, principles of vicarious liability would likely still be the same. We have the additional advantage of having the insurance code provisions with regard to 21.02, but I think the principles are basically the same. That is a representation of the policy conditions that aren't, in fact, true. And therefore, they should be responsible for the communication of that false information, which caused him to be employing and using drivers that otherwise would be excluded when he could have procured the insurance otherwise or not hired such drivers at his choice had he known that exclusion existed and didn't know.
He had had previous policies with the same agency which covered drivers under 25, had he not?
Correct, Your Honor. And he regularly reported the additional drivers. Whenever he had any additional drivers, he would report those to the Dave Masner Insurance Agency anyway, who actually would take the step of doing some kind of a driver's check to make sure that these are people that were likely to be accepted as an underwriting risk. And that's what Plaintiff's Exhibit 6 is with regards to the very driver that is here in question. We really believe that there is ample basis for the affirmance of the trial court judgment as to the liability against the underwriters at Lloyd's and the Dave Masner Insurance Agency.
Any questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent underwriters, Ms. Lloyd.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew Woolley will present argument for Lloyd. Respondent Lloyd.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Woolley and I'm here for the respondent Lloyd's with the court's permission. Mr. Hedges, who is also on a brief with me, will assist me with some big blow-ups of the graphic aid that hopefully the justices have before them as I speak here in light of Justice Cook's recent article. This case is an excellent case to challenge your ability as a lawyer because it keeps moving on me. In the Court of Appeals, basically the argument I was dealing with was that a surplus lines carrier could not, as a matter of law, have a soliciting agent. That seems to have been abandoned along the way. And I came here today thinking that we were going to be arguing largely about alleged representations or non-disclosures by the agent prior to issuance and delivery of the policy, and I find instead that what we're dealing with is basically negligence. So it's going to change the thrust of my response some, but let me get on with it. I think I need to bring out some things that are there in the briefs, but if everybody hasn't dwelled on the briefs, you ought to have this in the context that this is not a case involving an insurance carrier and its employee agent, or an insurance carrier and a captive agent. This is not a case involving a so-called local recording agent or an agent with the powers of a local recording agent that is merely being labeled a soliciting agent. This is a $25,000 property damage case involving an independent insurance agent through whom the petitioner had previously secured insurance of various types over the years. There's no evidence of any prior dealings with Lloyd's, but evidence of substantial prior dealings with the agent. This is a case in which the petitioner judicially admitted in his pleadings, the pleadings he went to trial on, that the independent insurance agent was his agent for obtaining the insurance. His testimony is in the record, is consistent with that judicial admission. This is a case in which the jury found that the independent agent failed to procure coverage as requested by the petitioner. That's the jury finding that the petitioner Masner agent breached an agreement to provide coverage for drivers under age 25. The evidence in the case, however, is conclusive that Lloyd's issued exactly the policy that was requested by the agent, that is, a policy that did not provide coverage for drivers under age 25. The only direct conduct of Lloyd's.
I'm sorry, say that last thing again.
The evidence is undisputed that the agent asked Lloyd's to issue a policy that did not provide coverage for drivers under 25, and that's exactly what Lloyd's issued, was a policy that did not provide coverage for drivers under age 25. The evidence is undisputed that Lloyd's never issues coverage for drivers under age 25 in these physical damage policies. The agent and everyone in the agent's office knew this. The real dispute in this thing arises out of the...
Before you move on to another point, you're telling us that the record shows that Lloyd's did not have sold a policy for an additional premium to cover underage drivers?
That exact fact is in the evidence, undisputed, Your Honor.
Be all that as it may, you're saying there's no evidence to support these jury findings?
Many of the findings. The ones that I've attacked is no evidence points in the brief. I don't believe we've attacked the finding that the exclusion endorsement was not attached when received by the petitioner because the evidence was conflicting. The petitioner said it wasn't attached. The agent said it was.
What did the jury say?
There was no issue on it. Well, I'm sorry. The jury found it was not attached. And as I say, I don't think we've attacked that finding.
You're stuck with that then.
I'm stuck with that finding, Your Honor. But on the other hand, the evidence is undisputed that when the agent, Masner, received the policy from Lloyd's, the exclusion endorsement was attached. There's testimony from Mr. Cox and there's testimony from Ms. Waldrop. That's all the evidence there is on that subject.
It was a banker?
I take issue with that characterization of the record, Your Honor. As I recall the record, what the banker testified was they had destroyed their policy. By the time anybody got around to asking them, what do you have in your files, the banker had destroyed it, thrown out the file, and could no longer remember and could no longer produce the policy to determine whether or not the exclusion endorsement, the under 25 exclusion endorsement, was attached to the mortgage payee copy of the policy.
Was the bank unaware of this controversy and ultimate lawsuit?
when it threw away the policy?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think it's in the record.
Sounds like the jury attached some importance to it.
I think the jury undoubtedly did attach importance to it, and I'm not sure the jury fully appreciated any pecuniary interest the bank might have had in the resolution of the lawsuit. But I agree, I think they did attach importance to it. As I was getting into, the only direct conduct by Lloyds was denial of the claim. There was absolutely no contact between the petitioner and American Underwriters or petitioner and Lloyds before or after the loss other than demand for payment of the loss and refusal of loss. This is a case in which the evidence was conclusive that the agent's authority, actual authority, was limited to receiving and forwarding applications for insurance. Everybody from the Masner Agency who was asked and who testified on that subject in the record said, that's all we can do, that's all we've ever been able to do. We knew Lloyds wouldn't issue coverage for drivers under 25. We knew there was no point asking. They wouldn't even do it for an additional premium.
But assuming that the Lloyds issued policy that did have the exclusion in it, and the jury finding that the insured received a policy without the exclusion in it, I understand the petitioners argue that the Lloyds had a duty to cause a correct copy of the policy to be transmitted to the insured, and that it's a violation of that duty that forms the basis of the recovery. What's the response to that?
That's where we're going to get into my about third flowchart, Your Honor. It's about page 3 of the exhibits before you, the one that looks kind of like a clock face. And that's where we're going to have to talk about who was whose agent when and what for. And you essentially have three things at play here. You have one, the judicial admission by the petitioner that Masner acted as his agent for purposes of obtaining the insurance. That's in his Fifth Amendment original petition. He went to trial on his testimony consistent with it. You further have a finding by the jury, which is also one of the exhibits before you, where the jury refused to find ratification by Lloyds of the acts or omissions of the agent. And then finally, you have the one jury finding there is as to agency, and that is issue number 17, that Masner acted as the agent for Lloyds in the handling of the insurance contract. So we didn't have to focus on what is handling of the insurance contract. And the way I've analyzed this, in step one, you have an application prepared between the petitioner and the agent. There is no contract of insurance at this point. So there's no insurance contract to be handled. So you don't have any agency between Masner and Lloyds. What you have at this point is agency between Masner and the petitioner. In step two, the agent transmits the application to American Underwriters. Again, you have no policy at this point, no insurance contract, nothing to be handled. So you're still dealing strictly with Masner acting as Heaton's agent. Step three, American Underwriters issues the policy. You now have an insurance contract. So the finding of the jury that Masner acted as agent for Lloyds and the handling of the insurance contract comes into play. Then step four, American Underwriters transmits the policy to Masner. At this point, Masner receives the policy. Now, arguably, as the petitioner would have it, he receives the policy solely as agent for Lloyds. As I would have it, he receives the policy, quote, in the handling of the insurance contract.
Did the American Underwriters require a report of the names of the driver under that policy?
No, Your Honor. That's another place where I regretfully am going to have to ask the court to confront the record, because the parties are at odds over what the record means and what the record says in that respect. Now, we've endeavored to simplify that analysis with the Exhibit B in our Appendix B in our brief, where we've denoted the record references for what the petitioner asserts is in the record and what we believe the record reflects.
Well, does the record reflect that Masner requested a Heaton list of the names of the drivers?
Bearing in mind, Masner is an independent insurance agent.
I'm talking about the record. Does the record reflect that Heaton furnished this information to Masner?
The record reflects Heaton did furnish such information to Masner.
At the request of Masner.
The record is not as clear on whether Heaton voluntarily did it based on past course of conduct or whether there was a specific request from Masner that he do it. But...
And the record doesn't reflect whether American Underwriters required this information of its agent Masner.
The record is clear on that, Your Honor. They did
no
not. American Underwriters, the application for coverage from American Underwriters was physical damage coverage on what I call property damage, collision, for these commercial trucks and trailers. Mr. Heaton was there to see Mr. Masner, or Masner Agency, to get quotes for general liability coverage, workers' compensation, cargo insurance, and physical damage. The only one that went to American Underwriters was the physical damage proposal. The evidence is undisputed. American Underwriters did not require a driver list, did not require any personal data on drivers, and did not require any driving histories on drivers. There is evidence in the record that this information was provided by Mr. Heaton to Mr. Masner, but what we try to make clear in our brief is this had to do with general practices of the Masner Agency particularly the general liability coverage that quote was being sought on. In that same vein, there was a mention in the petitioner's argument about a binder. Now, that's another area. That binder came several months later. That was not a binder of initial coverage. The only binder I'm aware of in the record was a binder issued. The policy was issued in December, late December 1977. This binder came along in February of 78. It was a binder to add additional trailers to the policy. It was not a binder of initial coverage. I believe you'll find the record clear that only American Underwriters could bind coverage, not the Masner Agency. But your question takes us right to the heart of why I have a problem with the approach or the relief petitioners are seeking here, where you have an independent insurance agent with all kinds of duties to the applicant for insurance, repping for a number of carriers. I just don't see how in a world that functions you can establish precedent that will make a carrier strictly and absolutely liable for anything that independent insurance agent does, irrespective of the agent's actual or apparent authority, which is the argument I hear being made through here, is that essentially if a carrier elects to accept an application through an agent and sell a policy through that agent, then the carrier should be strictly and absolutely liable for anything that the agent does or fails to do. The situation just won't bear up under that kind of legal superstructure imposed over it, I submit.
I think they're asking for strict liability. They're couching their theory on negligence and a duty to transmit a policy.
As I was getting to here, you've got the judicial admission that Masner is Heaton's agent, and you've got the jury finding that he's Lloyd's agent for handling the contract. There are two further points on that. One is the delivery to Masner was delivery to Heaton.
Yeah.
That essentially, the argument that Lloyd's chose Masner, Heaton also chose Masner. Judicially admitted his choice of Masner and so testified.
So
one position that affirms the judgment of the Court of Appeals is that when the policy was delivered to Masner, and the evidence is undisputed, the exclusion endorsement was there when Masner received the policy, that delivery was complete, constructive receipt by Heaton. The other problem on that, there are two problems, one of which I'm just not going to have time to get into, is the lack of a finding on the causal connection between the damage issue in this case and the negligence finding. But going by that for a moment, the other problem is that this appeal is from a judgment based on insurance code and DTPA findings. There's no judgment here on negligence. There's no judgment here on contract liability. And while this court recognized in, I believe, the Birchfield or the Boyce Ironworks decision that a plaintiff doesn't have to make a formal election and doesn't have to waive jury findings in order to take a judgment on the most favorable theory of recovery, he can't
rest on his laurels forever. And the petitioner in this case has never, till this good day, never asked any court to modify the trial court's judgment and give him a judgment on negligence. He did not bring forward a cross point in the Court of Appeals. He did not, in his prayer for relief in the Court of Appeals, ever request that the trial court's judgment be modified to award a negligence.
He had a theory that gave him the most money, didn't he?
Well, I agree, Your Honor.
I didn't expect it.
But when the Court of Appeals issued its first opinion and said reverse and remand the entire case, he still did not ask that the trial court's judgment be modified and give him a judgment on negligence. Then when the Court of Appeals granted the rehearing motion of Lloyds and reversed and rendered as to Lloyds and reversed and remanded as to Masner, he still did not ask the Court of Appeals to modify the trial court's judgment and award him a negligence recovery. And in his application for writ to this court, he has still not asked for that. So I submit to the Court of Appeals judgment can't be an error for having failed to do what nobody's ever asked him to do. The other last gasp point I would try to make here.
Before you do that, I suppose there's no finding on who was managing the principal at the time he got the policy.
No.
If he was a dual agent at that point, he was acting both for American Underwriters and Keaton at that point in time. What's the result?
Well, my argument is that the plaintiff failed to get his finding. He waived it. And that last gasp point is there's going to be some argument, hopefully, in the respondent Masner's presentation concerning the damage issue and the failure damage issue to identify actors and causes or theories of liability. There's a distinction between this case and the Frank P. Hall versus Beach case and the Transamerica Title versus San Benito Bank and Trust case, even separate and apart from the conflict between those decisions and the Loveless versus Sabine Consolidated case out of the 14th, and that is none of those Corpus Christi Court of Appeals cases involve a situation where the plaintiff had a judgment based on a non-existent cause of action or a cause of action that as a matter of law was not a producing cause of any injury. And in this case, one of the plaintiff's findings that the jury says the judgment, the damage issue is grounded on, is the failure of Lloyds to disclose to the petitioner that he did not possess a certificate of authority to do business in Texas. And I submit that that is not just a distinction, that's a material difference between those cases saying that failure to object weighs any complaint about the damage issue, as in the Birchfield or Wilkes versus Barr. I would also submit that Lloyds, in the particular facts of this case, was entitled to rely on the objection of Masner, a co-defendant and co-appellant.
Let me ask one question. The policy issued by American Underwriters, the fifth exclusion, was the exclusion a separate piece of paper that was stapled to the policy? How did it attach to the policy when it left the underwriting office?
I am not sure that the record is completely clear on that,
Your Honor. The record is clear on this.
But the usual procedure is that it is a separate piece of paper. It's not in the regular printed policy.
But the evidence is clear on that. It was a separate piece of paper, and I believe it's Defendant's Exhibit 6. It's one of the Defendant's Exhibits that has the policy as Lloyds issued the policy. Now, and there's testimony from the Masner folks that all of those pieces of paper were there when they received the policy. But I just don't recall if they were stapled together.
That they were not all there when they got to Mr. Keaton.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from Defendant Masner.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Higgins will present argument for
Respondent Dave Masner.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the court, Roger Higgins on behalf of Dave Masner Insurance Agency. I'll be addressing the points raised by the petitioner, Heaton, as well as raising a point that has been granted as to Dave Masner Insurance Agency. Listening to the arguments, I'm somewhat confused. The plaintiff, Mr. Heaton, has approached this case on two different types of theories. One, is it Masner's fault? Two, is it Lloyd's fault? There's an insurance contract, components of which were at issue at trial and were hotly contested, that governs the relationship between Lloyd and Heaton. There is no contract between, no written contract between Masner and Heaton, that side of the agency relationship that Heaton here today in argument admitted existed. It's a twofold relationship. Masner had an agency relationship and was Heaton's agent.
There is no contract
evidencing that relationship. During the course of this case, Petitioner Heaton has chosen to
straddle the fence,
to play whichever side is convenient, and that's caused a substantial amount of confusion. And I'd like to point some of that confusion out to the court today. As
the brief shows,
it's kind of difficult, but it's special issue number 26, and I might also add that that is attached as an exhibit to Lloyd's brief. The issues were tied to the occurrence in question. I would challenge Heaton to show the court what occurrence issue number 26 is talking about. This case, as far as Masner was concerned, arose before 1977, over a decade and a half ago. Masner and Heaton did indeed have a relationship where Masner sold and purchased policies for Mr. Heaton. In December of 1977, Masner obtained or applied for a policy through Lloyd's on a form that was provided by Lloyd for Mr. Heaton. Heaton signed that proposal, and it was again on American Underwriters form, as has been admitted today. Lloyd's issued and compiled and delivered the policy. The policy had a cover note addressing the court's prior question today. The policy did refer to the underage driver's exclusion endorsement, by the way. On the front page of the policy that was actually delivered, plaintiff's exhibit number one, the policy had a cover note which referred to the underage driver's exclusion endorsement as a condition which excluded drivers under 25.
However, that endorsement,
at least it was disputed, and the jury found that endorsement was not attached. So there was a reference on the cover page of the policy actually delivered. All this occurred in late 1977 or early 1978. An accident occurred in October of 78,
$25,000
in property damage, no personal injury. In November of 78, Lloyd's denied the claim based upon the underage driver's
exclusion endorsement.
And approximately 3 years later, Heaton added Masner to the lawsuit against Lloyd. Several disputes arose at trial where the endorsement was attached, what Masner agreed to do for Heaton. And interestingly, the plaintiff chose an alternative and somewhat confusing approach to trying the case,
which is borne out
by the issues and is one reason why we can't tell what occurrence they're referring to. On the one hand, the jury found that Masner contracted to provide Heaton an insurance policy to include drivers under the age of 25. In issue number one,
the jury found
that Masner, or that
a policy was
delivered without that underage driver's exclusion on it. The jury found that Lloyd's breached its policy by not paying a claim involving a driver under the age of 25. The jury found that Lloyd failed to settle the claim in good faith after liability had become reasonably certain. The policy did cover accidents involving drivers under the age of 25. On the other side of the coin,
which is
one of the other approaches that they took, the jury found that Masner breached a contract to provide an insurance policy to cover drivers under the age of 25.
Further inconsistently, the jury found that Masner represented to Heaton that it would provide an insurance policy that covered drivers under the age of 25 when it did not. Again, inconsistent with the finding that Lloyd's breached the policy. In issue number 2A and B, Lloyd's and Masner were both negligent. Again, inconsistent with the finding that Lloyd's breached the policy or violated duty of good faith and fair dealing and failing to pay the claim. And probably significantly is issue number 16, which said Lloyd's did not ratify Masner's acts in representing that it would provide a policy that covered drivers under the age of 25. This conflict, and we would have certainly asserted in the Court of Appeals that this is an irreconcilable conflict in these two theories. One cannot determine which of the issues under issue 26 the occurrence referred to is there. I would assert to the court, trying to direct to my point on my point of error, which is the Court of Appeals error in applying the four-year statute of limitation to Masner. We have no written contract between Masner and Heaton on the agency side of the relationship. So you have what the jury found to be an oral contract involving that agency relationship, the agreement to obtain an insurance policy. Again, the Court of Appeals erred for not applying the two-year statute of limitations. The fact is there's no written contract. Masner was not a party to the insurance contract. Masner was not a party to the application, even though his name is stamped on it just for identification or clerical reasons. It created no obligations on the part of Masner. It created in the application, and the policy created no obligations on the part of Masner. So those two writings do not evidence a contract between Masner and Heaton. The petitioner attempts to avoid the two-year statute of limitations by arguing, well, the pre-79 insurance and DPPA should apply a four-year statute of limitations. The pre-79 DPPA and insurance code did not have a statute of limitations. Subsequently, the legislature amended it and added a two-year limitation. The Heaton relies on several cases involving the DTPA, the pre-79 DTPA that apply a four-year statute. However, each of those cases do not, each of those cases involve a written contract between the parties, unlike here, where we have an oral contract arising from the agency relationship. Petitioner Heaton argues that the application should be create a contract between Masner and Heaton. Clearly, that does not meet the standard that this court has set out for determining whether there is a written contract between Masner and Heaton. There is simply no obligation evidence in that application on the part of Masner that's at issue in this case. Perhaps my argument seems a little disjointed, but I really submit to the court that it's not. The failure to have a written contract between Masner and Heaton has led Heaton into taking a approach in how they pursue this case against Lloyd and Heaton. The that created many internal and material conflicts that cannot be resolved when one looks at the issues. Perhaps if we had a written contract between Masner and Heaton, then some of these issues could be a little bit more defined. However, that underscores the purpose of the statute of limitations. If you don't have a written contract evidencing those relationships, Masner's act led to the problem, and then they didn't identify, over objection of Masner, what occurrence was being referred to. With that, I try to keep my arguments brief. I think that the question on statute of limitations has been addressed by both parties in brief. Court has any questions, I'd
Mr. glad Higgins, to. Are written contracts customary between soliciting agents and insurers?
Generally not, Your Honor. It's been my experience that they are not.
So Masner operated as a soliciting agent, I'm sure, for a good many clients.
Indeed, Your Honor.
Did they have written contracts with some of those clients? Any other?
I would not know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I don't believe
it's
addressed in there.
Well, really, it's not customary to have a written contract.
Generally, I do not believe it's customary to have a written contract between the prospective insured and the agent. Yet, in conclusion, Masner requests that the court reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and render in favor of Masner in addition to Lloyd.
Any questions? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
May it please the court, let me attempt to unstraddle the fence, as I have been accused of doing, with regards to what my position is, which I really thought was, at least I have intended to be clear. Sometimes my best intentions are not communicated. The discussions we had with regards to negligence were induced by questions, not really that we are attempting to affirm this judgment on a negligence theory, because we think we can affirm the judgment on the theory that we have. We don't have any particular problem with regards to that. On the other hand, a negligent breach of contract may also constitute a breach. The issue that we have discussed in terms of the breach issue and why there's not any irreconcilable conflict is we're talking about breach with regards to the delivery of the policy. We're talking about regards to the choice that they had with regards to who they used for the agent to deliver the policy. There isn't any irreconcilable conflict anyway. There are only alternative theories of recovery. That doesn't create any irreconcilable conflict. This court has held that many times. The courts of this state do not hold that because you have differing theories and versions of the fact that you do not get to choose whichever theory gets you the most recovery, which is obviously the case of the treble damage recovery. We have not taken the position, and don't take the position, that the contract of insurance issued by Lloyd's intended to be communicated to the insured and to be a form and part of the policy in question did have the exclusion upon which they denied coverage. What we have denied is that they did not use any means by which it was calculated to get there. That's both a breach of their contract with regards to the making of it in the first place. It is also a misrepresentation of the terms of the policy that was actually delivered by virtue of its deletion. In fact, the policy that was delivered has in its printed terms an underage exclusion, that is underage 18. This endorsement that they're talking about is in fact a separate sheet of paper. It's attached at the very end of the policy that they produced at the trial, and it doesn't even have a number or a form on it. Now, the testimony at the trial basically was by the Masner people, because it was essential in essence to their defense as well, obviously not believed, however, was that they had and got that form, that they had checked it. They have a procedure by which they check and make sure everything is there, that they transmitted it on, and that they then transmitted it on to us. The finding by the jury on disputed testimony is we didn't have it. And incidentally, with regards to the testimony of the executive vice president, while the policy that of the bank had testified, while the policy was not in existence at that time, he testified that Mr. Heaton had come in and asked him, is this endorsement on your policy? He distinctly recalled, no, it was not. And so they, at that time, that's what the testimony was, that the lost payee's policy didn't have that endorsement either. Now, viewing that testimony in light of the jury findings, the point is that the jury could well have concluded that the mistake was made earlier up the chain and that Heaton actually never did get the exclusion from Lloyd's. That is an inferable from the fact that it was not received and from the testimony that could have been partially believed, partially disbelieved by the Masner people, by Mr. Cox, to the effect that I transmitted what I got. And his recollection that what he got included this could well have been predicated on his knowledge that that's generally the way that Lloyd's operated. Now, there is testimony in the record that the Masner agency can place policies for an additional premium as well that would delete that exclusion. I'm not certain whether or not that testimony is exactly specific as to whether Lloyd's will delete the exclusion, but clearly that it is a deletable exclusion. I think there is testimony that relates to Lloyd's itself, but we've made recitations to that and those record references in the brief, and they'll stand for what they are.
But I understand Lloyd's to argue that Masner was Heaton's agent for delivery of the policy, for receipt of the policy. What's the response to that?
The response to that, I think, quite clearly is both in the facts and the insurance code, Your Honor. The fact is that the policy transmittal was done by Lloyd's to that agency. They are, even if he's a dual agent, they are nonetheless liable with regards to the transmittal and correct transmittal of the policy terms. That's precisely provided in the insurance code in 2102 in its provisions as it applied at the time, which specifically provided, it's quoted in our brief, which says, whoever solicits insurance on behalf of any insurance company who takes or transmits any application for insurance or any policy of insurance to or from such company, or shall receive or deliver a policy of insurance of any such company, or receive or collect or transmit any premium of insurance, all of which was done, or do any other act in the making or consummating of any contract insurance for or with such insurance company, shall be held to be the agent of the company for which the act is done or the risk is taken. That was the basis of the Titans Life Insurance versus Otis Harris case, coupled with a finding of actual and apparent authority that the court said even the soliciting agent nonetheless liable with regards to deceptive trade practice, with regards to things that are not covered. But we are dealing here with an unusual situation in that we're not talking about representations as to Lloyd's, as to that they would cover something and then issue a policy that is delivered that in fact does not cover it. We are talking here with a breakdown in the delivery of the policy, which does not purport to not cover the very loss in question. It doesn't have anything in it that will exclude this loss. And the agency for that communication was chosen by the insurer. They didn't produce anybody at trial. American Underwriters doesn't have any testimony in this record. They don't have any witnesses that they sponsored or that they came down in which they took any position, either American Underwriters or Lloyd's. And American Underwriters is a general agent for Lloyd's in the United States. These things are written and transmitted on American Underwriters. Its application bears American Underwriters stamp. It bears the Dave Masner Insurance Agency logo at the bottom in terms of that's typed in as they're the ones that assisted in the preparation of the application and the original transmittal of it. They may well be dual agents at all stages. They are certainly the agents for Lloyd's in the transmittal of the policy back. That's a representation of the terms of the policy. And the representation of the terms of the policy in this case were false. That's what caused the loss and the resulting damage.
But if Heaton had gone to Masner and said, get me a policy that covers underage 25 driving, Masner said, all right. And Heaton said, but I want you to get it, you take it, you keep it, I don't want anything else to do with it. Don't send it to me. Masner approached Lloyd's, said, give me a policy, but did not request one with that coverage. Lloyd's issued policy that did not provide that coverage, delivered to Masner. Masner kept it as instructed, and then this occurred. Then would, under those circumstances, would Heaton have a cause of action against Lloyd's?
If the relationship that is developed, that is between Dave Masner Insurance Agency and Lloyd's, is such that he is responding and acting as if he were the insured solely for the receipt and keeping of the policy. Assuming the policy they sent to it has the exclusion in it, then it may well be that under those circumstances they would not be so held. But here we have findings of actual authority and apparent authority, which are predicated largely on the use of the forms, the transmittal of the premium that is being done and that is collected and that is arranged to be collected. In fact, it was even arranged to be financed by the Masner Insurance Agency.
What is the effect of the finding of no ratification by Lloyd's?
That's a finding of no ratification in the sense that they didn't ratify that they had agreed to cover. They didn't in any way attempt to cover the loss. That is a representation that this would cover. I don't think that there is any legal effect of that at all except with regards to the pre-policy issuance representations. But that's not the sole basis. If I might add, as before I run out of time totally without dealing with the issue, in special issue number 26, which is the damage issue, which has been discussed as being very confusing and that we didn't have all these allocation things, the reliance on the cases like Lucas versus Nesbitt and the other cases saying you haven't segregated the damages that were caused by the DTPA findings is simply not true on the face of the issue itself, because it has a second counterpart. It's attached, in fact, to the brief of the other side, in which the question inquires as with regards to the answers of A through E, that's all the damages issues, which that said damages you find were caused by the actual omissions which you found in answers to issues 11, 13, 14, and 18. 18 is Lloyd's direct. 11, 13, and 14 are the DTPA findings with regards to Masner and those issues. It says find which ones of those were caused, and the answer is A, B, C, D, E, all of them. were caused by the DTPA. So what we have here is just a basis for joint and several liability. The objections they make with regards to allocation that were only made incidentally by Masner and not even made by Lloyds, but those objections, I think the court will look at them, don't have anything to do with our ability to get a judgment against them. At worst, it has to do with the interstate liability between the two defendants, which frankly is not before the court, as I don't think there's any, been any complaint about the fact that there was a denial of the indemnity that that the Court of Appeals took away when they reversed and rendered. I believe this case is ripe for rendition in the absence of cross points.
Any questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument on the second clause. We'll take another recess.
Please rise.